On the line with us today, the Honorable Congressman from the 3rd District of the northwestern half of the state of Oklahoma, Congressman Frank Lucas. Congressman Lucas, of course, hometown is Cheyenne, but we are talking with him today from his office in our nation's capital. Congressman, several things to chat with you about today, including the latest that you're hearing regarding the American Jobs Plan of President Joe Biden. This proposal, all about a lot of infrastructure needs and apparently a lot more, Congressman. Your thoughts about this particular measure, your thoughts about the president's ability to get this across the finish line?
Ron, I think the Biden administration is trying to use the name of infrastructure to fund their wish list to take care of all their other projects in one mighty $2.25 trillion package. And remember, we don't seem to use billion anymore. Everything is trillions of dollars as we advance to this point. Supposedly, it will address roads and bridges and those kind of things, which have always been bipartisan in nature. But if you look at how the money's actually spent, about 6% will go to roads and bridges of that $2.25 trillion. About 2% will go to waterways, ports, airports. Less than 5% will go to broadband, which is a very important thing to all of us out here. And generally then the money is scattered across a long wish list of stuff. The administration almost constantly uses the phrase social justice and climate justice in their proposal. So about 40% of what's in the bill goes to what they refer to as climate and clean investments. Basically, it's a little bit of highway bill, it's a little bit of road bill, it's a little bit of bridge bill, but it's a whole lot of everything else in their agenda. In its present form, I have a hard time believing this will actually make it into law. Oh, and don't forget, in the process of spending this money on one-time projects, they want to raise the corporate income tax rate from 21 to 28%. And we went through a lot of struggles in recent years to get that rate down so that we would be competitive with foreign tax rates on corporations to keep U.S. companies from going overseas and trying to bring U.S. companies back home. And this would undo all of that. So call it infrastructure if you work at the White House. Call it a massive spending bill if you're going to pay the bill. And ultimately, the American taxpayers will pay the bill for this.
I know that there's at least some talk about this might be another one of his reconciliation runs to try to avoid a supermajority or 60 vote threshold over in the Senate. Is that a possibility?
I think that's absolutely true, Ron. And for our listeners' benefits, under the 1974 Budget Act, there was a way in each budget cycle to reduce spending, make it simpler to pass the legislation through the House and Senate to reduce spending. Just as they used budget reconciliation to pass their $1.9 billion partisan COVID package at the beginning of the Biden administration, now we're technically in a different budget cycle. So in the name of legislation that was created to reduce spending, they're going to use this, I believe, the budget reconciliation, to try and raise spending by at least $2.25 trillion. Raise spending, and don't be surprised if they roll the entire federal regular budget into this and we just have one giant, massive vote later this fall. One massive vote which will increase social spending, it will increase taxes, there'll be some roads and bridges in it, but oh my goodness, what a way to run a business doing one piece of legislation and probably on a complete party line vote without input from the minority.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the aspects of that particular measure, some of the things that they're throwing around, billions and billions of dollars, which adds up to those trillions. One is that rural broadband initiative, the efforts to try to improve rural broadband. Your old committee, House Ag Committee, yesterday, in fact, holding a hearing on rural broadband. And one of the numbers that one of the folks that testified used to fully get this thing done, assuming you've got all, you know, you figure out where all the gaps are, a lady from Microsoft said $60 to $80 billion. Is that the kind of money you're hearing that will take to really address broadband across, most of rural America?
Going about the way we are now, that's probably not an unreasonable number, Ron. Remember, we had money in the last farm bill. We've had money in the CARES packages. We've had money in virtually everything to keep moving these processes forward. And we're seeing that money being spent in Oklahoma and a number of rural states across the country. I would suggest to you that with the technology we have right now, increasing the fiber availability, increasing the connects is important, and we've got to spend what we have. But there are also some other things on the horizon coming up. There are three different companies that are working on low Earth orbit satellites, Elon Musk being one of them, but two other competitors also working on the low-level orbital satellite system where we would get our broadband perhaps in the 100-megabyte range from satellites. That will create competition for the landline system. But right now, spending money on the traditional landline system is the best way to move internet or broadband forward. But that's a lot of money, I know. But if as we've discovered in the COVID-19 experience, not only is telemedicine critically important in rural America, and you've got to have broadband to deliver that information back and forth in a timely way to make it work, it's also been critical that with literally the school systems shut down for months and months and months and months, if we were going to make education work, we had to have access to that. So once again, broadband is critically important. And ask any farmer, ask any business person who does business, whether it's tracking the markets or buying equipment or judging the weather or just an incredible number of things are required to conduct our business lives in rural America and in farming and ranching off of the access to the internet through the broadband. So it's something we have to do. As the alternatives increase, I think that will help bring down the price, but you can't be left behind. I have now for a year, when I've been home, been doing meetings with congressional committees, stuff with the United States House in general, on Teams or Zoom or WebEx, a variety of things. And when your download speed is around 4 megabytes and your upload speed is a half a megabyte, as I'm discovering at home on the farm and roll, it's hard to make the technology work. It's personal for all of us who are trying to make our copper wires work in the world we're operating in now in rural America. Something has to happen.
I guess what in your role over on the Science Committee, you're seeing firsthand some of these low Earth orbit type of concepts being talked about a lot.
Absolutely. And there's three different companies competing with that, putting smaller satellites in orbit. The key is they have to be low enough in orbit that you get a prompt response time up and down, back and forth. The satellites, whether it's for television or a variety of other things we use, are all higher, tending to be geosynchronous orbits, and the upload and download speeds just aren't sufficient for what we need to do for business and education. So this is one of the opportunities. But again, until those options are available, we have to continue to build out the fiber networks. We have to continue to build out the landline networks. We have to make sure every community has access, and we have to make sure as many people as possible have access, because those of us, as you've heard me say many times, Ron, who live at the end of the rural electric power line, who live at the end of the rural district co-op water line, who live at the end of the REA line, who live at the end of the dirt road, the end of the independent phone company line, we deserve the same kind of access to this as everybody in urban and suburban America.
I guess what you make reference, obviously, to the electric co-op model, and that's going to be, a prime part of this overall plan to try to get the build out in rural Oklahoma, rural America.
Exactly. They have a solid track record of taking care of their member customers, constituents for decades and decades and decades, but whoever delivers the service has to be there if we're going to retain our population in rural Oklahoma, America for that matter, if we're going to retain our younger people. A lot of us will tolerate a lot of things for the privilege of living in the country and the wonderful life that it provides, but the younger generation, the under 40 crowd, they not only expect the same standard of living technology-wise, but they demand it, and if we can't provide it, they'll go somewhere else, and that'll be a huge loss for rural America and really for the country in that regard.
You alluded to the telehealth aspect of all of this on the broadband, and I know that you've been involved in working on legislation, working with some of your colleagues to try to make sure that we've got this type of health care available via our rural clinics or rural hospitals and the like.
As everyone knows, farming is one of the most perilous professions. And I live 17 miles from my local hospital. I'm 40 miles one direction to the next hospital. I'm 50-some miles to the next hospital. So again, like my constituents, I'm particularly sensitive about how important it is to have access to the most current and modern healthcare, and having the ability to be hooked up, whether it's when they put you in the ambulance or they put you in the helicopter or in the emergency room in whatever hospital we're in Oklahoma, and having access to people who in real time can work with the local healthcare professionals to determine what your problem is and how to respond appropriately is critically important. In the CARES Act, there was $200 million for funding through the COVID-19 telehealth program, because as the medical community and our society ground to a halt for a time under COVID-19, this stuff became blatantly obvious. There was additional money in the final appropriation bill of 2020, and myself and a number of other members are sending letters and encouraging the Federal Communications Commission to support rural communities in their second round of funding for this stuff. So we're trying. It's just a big need to fill, but the need is there, and it's become ever so more graphic in the lost year of 2020 when we had to have everything work perfectly for people to survive, and it worked well enough, but we're trying to fix the things that obviously need to work better.
You also mentioned one of those magic words as far as the Biden administration is concerned right now, climate and climate justice, sustainability, trying to, you know, deal with greenhouse gas emissions. I know that the president has basically got us engaged with the Paris Accords once again, and there's been obviously some folks are not too happy about that. You know, how is this all, in other words, how is this going to work as far as the agricultural community is concerned? Are they willing to go the carrot method, or are they going to try to use the stick instead?
It's the stick approach. And simultaneously, I think the Biden administration wants to set such a wonderful standard for the rest of the world, they'll follow our lead. And the Chinese are laughing at us. The stick approach, by mandating the reduction of use of certain forms of energy, by driving up the cost of those forms of energy, think fossil fuels, think traditional oil and gas, to compel people to give it up in an effort to force us to go to exclusively renewables. Iran, we saw in the weather that we dealt with a couple of months ago in the Southwest, in Texas and in Oklahoma, there are times when Mother Nature turns everything loose on you, when you've got to have every available energy source to keep the lights on, whether it's natural gas or wind or nuclear, hydro, like as we have in eastern Oklahoma, for instance, all of those sort of things. Had it not been for the coal-fired power plants that are still online in Oklahoma and Texas, we would have had, I believe, a total collapse of the electrical system in the Southwest. Those coal-fired plants kept things going in the worst 4 days, when everything else was freezing up, when the wind was not blowing correctly, when it was all coming apart. That's why you've heard me say for years and years and years, we have to have a set of energy sources that are varied in order to keep costs down and to keep supply available. I would argue, from as we do on as Republicans on the energy, the science committee, where we have jurisdiction over research programs dealing with energy, the key is innovation. How do you make the existing fossil fuels burn cleaner? Carbon sequestration, that sort of stuff. Until we develop the next ultimate generation of power source, how do you develop battery technology so that you can store electric wind and solar energy when it's produced, which is not always when we need it, to be able to draw upon it? How do we get the licensing process going so that we can use the next generation, the presently being put together generation of smaller nuclear plants using fission nuclear energy, to get us to the point where ultimately fusion power, the power of the sun, to turn basically salt water into power, that's ultimately where we go. But that may be 50 or 100 or 150 years away. How do we do this in a way that we can still be cool in the summer, warm in the winter, and have affordable energy to raise our crops and run our factories? The Biden folks, I believe, are so idealistic on forcing us to change our ways that they'll make our life more expensive and a whole lot less pleasant and our economy a whole lot less efficient in the name of setting a standard for the rest of the world. And right now, most of the rest of the world just smiles because, as for instance in China, as we turn down our emissions, they turn theirs up so they can sell us more stuff and take more of our money home.
Your time over on the House Ag Committee included, before you were chairman, you were subcommittee chair over on the conservation side of things. Do you feel like, you know, there's a lot of push, you know, to make sure farmers are engaged in this? They want farmers to have a big role in this greenhouse gas emission reduction. You feel like from what you're hearing that it will be, you know, they're going to be allowing farmers to, you know, engage in this in a positive way, or they, again, it's going to be a regulatory approach?
Well, right now they have a grand idea to do it, and there are no group of folks more sensitive to the environment than farmers and ranchers. The problem is, can they demonstrate that what they want to do will actually make a difference? Can they do it in a way that provides incentives that make it worthwhile for farmers and ranchers to do? And how do you quantify that? On the science committee, we're pushing for research dollars so we can actually take some of these thoughts that are being written out on the back of envelopes and turn them into real facts that you can quantify, you can work from. Right now, we have to be careful that they produce programs that provide incentives for farmers to participate, not produce programs where if you don't participate, you can't qualify for crop insurance, or you can't access certain research information, or you can't do this, or you can't do that. I'm a carrot guy. I want to incentivize things so that the market will encourage people to do the right thing for the right reason, because it's good economics and it's good environmental policy. I don't want to have somebody in D.C. decide that they don't like the way I'm farming and use every opportunity to force me to do it their way. That's not in the spirit of the 2018 Farm Bill or the 2014 Farm Bill, or in the way that you actually persuade some of the most independent people in the world, farmers and ranchers, to do something different.
One last question, Congressman. I know that in recent days there was some legislation that you helped advance in regards to designating, honoring, if you please, the Chisholm Trail. So one of the great legacy of trails that go across a good bit of Oklahoma up into Kansas and down south as well. Give me an update on that.
We're making progress. It's been filed on both sides. I will be honest with you, Ron. You might be surprised to know that one of the great debate issues as the bill was being put together was it the Great Western Trail or was it the Western Trail? I personally believe it should be called the Great Western Trail, but that we're working through. For those not familiar, this was one of the last great cattle trails that started in basically South Texas, taking cattle across what was then the Oklahoma Territory into Kansas and farther north. Sometimes people forget the key element in Oklahoma was as those cow herds came across those trail drives, they didn't go in a hurry. They were going slow because, one, they were paying the Indian tribes who they crossed for the privilege of grazing, and they were fattening those steers, fattening those cattle as they came across. They were pretty skinny when they left South Texas. By the time they got to the railroad pens in Kansas or wherever, they were ready to go to the stockyards in Chicago. So once again, we've always been the breadbasket of the country, even if it involved the Great Western Trail. God bless my fellow farmers and ranchers and the wonderful environment in Oklahoma.
Thank you, Congressman. Congressman Frank Lucas of Oklahoma's 3rd Congressional District, past chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, of course, currently top-ranking member of the Science Committee in the House of Representatives. On the Oklahoma Farm Report, I'm Ron Hayes.